From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Peter Arnett demonstrated remarkable bravery when he remained on the ninth floor of the Al Rashid Hotel during the first bombing attack of the Gulf War to report live on CNN. But Arnett said he'd been in more dangerous predicaments before. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Arnett's 35 years in war zones, reporting for the Associated Press and CNN. He's written a new memoir called Live from the Battlefield. Also today, Mongolian throat singing. World music critic Milo Miles reviews a recording by the Mongolian group Hun Her Tu. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the first American bombs dropped on Baghdad, Peter Arnett was on the ninth floor of the Al Rashid Hotel, describing it all live on CNN. His fame was instantaneous, but risking his life for a story was nothing new for him. The Gulf War was the 17th war he covered. Journalist David Halberstam has said that Arnett arguably has seen and done more combat coverage than anyone in the history of Western journalism. Arnett started reporting on war in 1961 when he began to cover Southeast Asia for the Associated Press. He was in Vietnam for much of the war and won a 1966 Pulitzer Prize. He left the wire service in 1981 to join CNN. He says back then the networks laughed at CNN and called it the Chicken Noodle Network, but they weren't laughing at the start of the Gulf War. Arnett has written an autobiography called Live from the Battlefield. I wanted to know what his first impulse was when the bombing of Baghdad began, to protect himself or to lunge for the microphone.
My first reflex was to go for the microphone to get the story out. That was the reason we were sent to Baghdad. We were expecting a development of one kind or another. So when the skies lit up, when it became clear that something very unusual was going on, I made a dash for the microphone. However, Bernard Shaw reached it a split second before me, and he had the privilege of announcing to the world that the bombing had indeed started.
Were you envious?
No. I am not envious of Bernie. I've admired him all my life, and in that case, I just felt that it was important that we get the story out. Part of me, maybe the competitive part, thought, well, gee, maybe I should have been fleeter of foot. But the realist in me was delighted that Bernie was up for the broadcast. Bernie reported not only the opening of the bombing, but stayed on the scene throughout the rest of the whole day. So we were a team working together.
You say in your memoir that you were afraid during the hours you were on the air of sounding shallow. Do you remember the kinds of things you said and the kinds of things you were worried about saying?
Well, the temptation was to compare the violence, the flashing lights, the noise, to what people identify with, Disneyland, New Year's Eve celebrations and fireworks. And I'd been around long enough to know that you cannot compare heavy bombing to any casual or trivial incident in life or any sort of show. But the temptation was, of course, to in a sense, glorify what was going on and get and to start describing the pyrotechnic effects rather than to remember that people were dying in these bombs and the bombing was undertaken with a mission to push back a belligerent.
How much could you tell about what was happening outside of the hotel?
We were very fortunate. Our bureau was on the ninth floor of the Al Rashid Hotel. It was as high a vantage point as you could hope for, short of being in a helicopter. In addition, we had visuals from both sides of the hotel because our suite connected to the northern part of the hotel and we were looking south. We could race back and forth and see the impact of the bombs. Now, the bombs were directed against several tall buildings in the Baghdad area, which were government offices, political offices, and security centers. We could literally see these buildings going apart. In addition, there was bombing of a petroleum production center along the Tigris River, which we could see, and there was just a lot of flares in the air. There was a lot of light, and so we could actually describe with considerable detail what was going on because we could just see it happening before us.
Did you wonder what the look on your face was during the most dangerous points of your broadcast? And did you ever look at those points on videotape and see how you did look?
Well, fortunately, you know, probably for all of us, the initial period was actually not on videotape. We were reporting radio through our four-wire transmission, which was what they call a hardened communication link. It was by cable, overland cable from Baghdad to Amman, Jordan, and then by satellite. So in that earlier period, we weren't going live on camera. Even though we had video taken of us, we were literally not live on camera. Those pictures were to come later when we got live opportunities. Now, later in the war, I was live on camera as bombs were exploding in the relative vicinity, and I just made a point of keeping calm and looking relatively unconcerned. Basically, in a situation when you commit yourself to war coverage, the decision to stay already moves you beyond being frightened or panic. Having decided to stay in a dangerous locale, you know what may come in your direction. You figure that maybe you will get killed, but having made the decision to stay there, I mean, you can be more calm about relating to what's going on.
It's remarkable that you were there, that you survived, that you were able to maintain contact during that night of bombing. Something that is remarkable in a very trivial way, but nevertheless remarkable, is I think it was the next day the music was on in the hotel. I just found that amazing.
Well, you know, in times of conflict and crisis, you know, life does sort of wind on.
But to be, you know, to have survived what you survived, to have made such an internationally earth-shaking report as you had done for the better part of 17 hours, and then you go downstairs, what, to the lobby and the music's on, that must have been mighty surreal.
Well, much of what happened in that hotel was surreal, which made it, to me, you know, an example of the new age of communications, the perception of the global village that was unique to me and to many to other journalists there, was that here we have a country at war, a capital under bombardment by belligerents. Forces to them, George Bush and the U.S. and allied armies and air forces were belligerents. They were entertaining, you know, representatives, media representatives from those allied countries, from the United States and elsewhere, and willing to tolerate us, to feed us, to shelter us. And even though they were aware that not all that was being broadcast would be beneficial to them, they wanted to participate in this global village idea of getting information out, getting their point of view out. To have that happen, of course, they needed to maintain adequate sheltering, adequate housing, adequate food. So we have the city disintegrating around us, yet they were serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They were playing muzak in the hotel and being quite accommodating, which was sort of a surprise to me, but I feel it's just part of how things are going to be in the future.
My guest is Peter Arnett, and he has a new memoir about his career as a journalist and all the wars that he's covered. It's called Live from the Battlefield. When did the censors show up, the Iraqi censors?
Later than we thought. When the bombing began and we started speaking freely on the air, describing everything we were watching, our presumption was that within a very short time, our minders, they were basically the censors, our minders would appear on the scene and either terminate our discussion or certainly control our discussion. What in fact happened was that the bombing, even though it had been threatened for weeks, caught Baghdad unexpectedly off guard. The city was not prepared. The air raid shelter, the air raid sirens were delayed. All the officials in the hotel panicked and rushed to the basement. The security people rushed to the basement. In fact, you know, most of the press corps rushed to the basement. We stayed in our room because we had communications. So we were able to speak freely. This went on all night and through most of the next day, and it was not till the following evening, 17 hours after we started, that the decision was made by the Iraqi Information Ministry to terminate our direct coverage. And they came up to our room and insisted that we stop broadcasting. At that point in time, we'd told all you could possibly tell, basically, about Baghdad. Censorship didn't come until that point. Now, a day after that, the second day of the bombing, we were told by the Iraqi officials that future transmissions would be censored, that they would read our dispatches before we put them on the air and then would continue to restrict us.
What were the guidelines that your censor gave you?
They said no military information of any kind would be permitted to be broadcast. And that concerned me because what was the definition of military information? Was it the weather? You know, was it the activity in Baghdad streets? I was really concerned about that limitation, and I spent the first few days of coverage, plus and the whole rest of the war, trying to enlarge the definition of military information. Now, initially, that information was understood by the Iraqis to mean that any attacks on government buildings, on installations which governments were using, whether they were ministries, military barracks, telecommunications centers, post offices, bridges, all this they forbid us to talk about. And initially, they attempted to restrict us to information about the prisoners of war, which they'd captured, government statements giving their version of the progress of the war, plus visitations to areas where there were civilian casualties.
Did they ever try to suggest what you should be reporting and what you should be saying?
They never at any point, you know, directly told me that I should be putting a greater spin on the Iraqi side of the war, but simply by restricting our visitation rights, by telling us that we could not talk to any military man, that we could not even mention we'd seen a military man, and by refusing to take us to any military installations to see any damage to military installations, that certainly restricted our vision. And by taking us in the countryside to areas where there had been only civilian damage and preventing us from reporting damage that we'd seen to military installations, it was quite restrictive. And in that way, they were controlling the information flow rather than by demanding that I report information more favorable.
Did you feel that by following their no military information guidelines that you were sacrificing your credibility or integrity?
Not at all, because similar restrictions were in place in Israel. They were in place in the Gulf, and I knew they were in place because my colleagues in Atlanta had told me the restrictions that the reporters were under. My mission each morning was to try to expand the horizon or expand the limitations that I was under. And I was very fortunate that in the first day that I was on the air with a satellite phone, because our major communication link, the four-wire hard line, was ultimately blown out of existence, and I started using the satellite phone, I was very fortunate that when the anchor in Atlanta started asking me questions and I responded, the Iraqi censors did not object to my unscripted answers. Now, the way it worked was that prior to going on the air, I would type out a couple of minutes of script. I would hand it to the Iraqis. They would go through it, check it out, and then give it back to me and say, okay, you can broadcast that. Now, I was restricted from making any offhand comments, but when I was talking to the anchors after each occasion, the Iraqis sort of allowed me to do that. I told them that it was important to better explain some of the details in my dispatch to inform the world and to better present their side of the story. They went along with that, and it reached the point where I was able to speak off the cuff for a half an hour, 40 minutes at a time. That was in addition to my two-minute scripted remark. So in that way, I think I was able to enlarge the degree of communication to a considerable amount.
CNN made it clear that your reports were being censored by the Iraqis. How did you feel about how CNN handled that?
I realized that it was necessary for CNN to label what I was saying. I was fully aware that by being, for a while, basically the only American journalist there for 2 weeks, that it was a controversial call. All the other journalists had left, basically. And I understood that it was important for CNN to label what I was saying and to be cautious about what I was presenting. Now, at one point, there was some comment in the hotel and elsewhere about my reports that were being relayed by the BBC and others, and those around the hotel were saying, well, you know, you're really getting nasty questions from your own anchors. People are saying you're a dupe of the Iraqis. People are saying you're just communicating propaganda. What do you say to that? In fact, at one point, Tom Johnson, the CNN president, said he'd got a note from Peter Jennings of ABC who said, you know, your anchors are treating Peter Arnett with more criticism than even his critics. But I sort of rolled with the punches on that. I felt that, you know, that I could answer the criticism. I wanted to respond to those who questioned my reasons for being in Baghdad, the kind of information I was producing. And I felt that's the price you pay for being on a controversial story.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Arnett, and he's written a new autobiography called Live from the Battlefield. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Arnett. He's written a new memoir called Live from the Battlefield. Were you ever worried about being used by the Iraqis?
I kept telling myself from the beginning that if their constraints became too great, I would leave. I would just get in a taxi and get out of the country. I told the Iraqis that I was not about to risk in 35 years of hard-won reputation for being an honest reporter. I wasn't about to risk that on the altar of, you know, Saddam Hussein's propaganda mission. And I assure you, if I'd ever been in doubt that I was getting the story out adequately, I would have packed up and left.
One of the real controversial moments, you were taken on a tour of some of the non-military sites that were bombed, taken by Iraqi chaperones. And one of the sites was what you described as a baby milk plant. But then Norman Schwarzkopf said, no, that's no baby milk plant. That's a biological weapons facility. So how could you be sure what it was?
Well, that did surprise me enormously when the Pentagon justified that bombing. We were taken there, in fact, I believe, the day after that installation was hit. I was along with myself with a crew from WTN, Jordanians who worked for the World Television News, who were taking video for us. There were some other Jordanian news people came along, a few diplomats, a few peace people who were at the hotel. There was a group of about 30 of us. We went to this installation that had been pretty much destroyed. It was about an acre of metal buildings. It had totally caved in. We moved about this installation. We went through it. We looked at documents. I picked up souvenirs. I picked up packets of powdered milk. And we spent a whole hour there. I went back to the hotel and did indeed report that one of the targets that had been, the Iraqis said, had been destroyed an Allied bombing the previous day was this industrial plant that provided baby milk for the Baghdad area. When I was criticized for reporting that information, presented as a dupe of the Iraqi government and told that I was actually in a biological testing center, I laughed because we walked freely around that installation. We took video of it, left, right, and center, sent that video back. There were no attempts to interfere with our coverage. There was the officials with us were not concerned about being contaminated, clearly. I brought the baby milk powder back to the hotel, handed it out to children who were in the shelter in the basement, including Iraqi children, and it just astounded me. It did not fit the profile at all of a dangerous environment, which a biological testing center would have been after it had been bombed.
So, do you think Schwarzkopf made a mistake, or that he was lying?
Well, we'll never know that. My feeling was that I know that the Pentagon made a mistake. They presumably had information that suggested that that was a biological testing center, and they were sticking to that story. I'm sure that they did not go after that target knowing that it was a baby milk plant. I mean, why bother knocking out a baby milk plant when there were far more significant targets in Baghdad? I think it was a mistaken intelligent assessment. Nearby that building, there was a pharmaceutical center that could well have been a baby milk plant. Just one last comment on that. The UN sent missions into Iraq when the war ended to investigate all areas of chemical and biological warfare. I know the American scientist who led that delegation, he said in all their trips, the baby milk plant was never listed as an installation to visit. And in fact, I do hear that it is now back producing milk. So I think I was right with that one. I think it was a mistaken bombing by the U.S., and it took them, they aren't willing to admit that it was a mistaken intelligent assessment.
So I guess in your mind, that is actually a good example of why it was important for you to stay and give information that may have contradicted what the American government was telling us.
Well, it was less contradiction. I wasn't interested in fighting U.S. government information. I just felt that at this point in time, as after many years in the field and getting the public attuned to having information that is contrary to national interests appearing in our media, that it made sense to present the other side of the story. And as I said on the air several times, you know, those who criticize my reports of civilian casualties have to realize, have to know, that when you launch the largest bombing campaign in history, you're going to hurt some civilians. And I pointed out that what I was able to see in Baghdad was, in fact, and in Baghdad and the rest of Iraq, was that the bombing campaign was essentially on target. There were not many civilian installations hit, but there were some, and I thought that we were in a position, being sophisticated enough in the United States and in the West, to accept that information. Now, I look back to history to justify what I was doing, and during the Vietnam War in Saigon, while I was there, Harrison Salisbury, the wonderful war correspondent, international correspondent of the New York Times, visited Hanoi. It was actually around Christmas of '66. He reported that U.S. bombing, contrary to what was being said in the Johnson administration, was sometimes hitting civilians. There were schools, some churches, other installations hit. And this was a fact of life. When he reported that information, there was enormous controversy in the United States. There were suggestions that he was being traitorous. But actually, that was important information for the U.S. public to have, that, you know, nothing is perfect in war, and certainly we were not perfect in North Vietnam. And that information there helped the public better understand the difficulties of waging that war and the problems that ultimately led to the American withdrawal and the South Vietnamese defeat.
Peter Arnett has written a new memoir called Live from the Battlefield. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peter Arnett will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Peter Arnett had reported from war zones for 30 years when his CNN reporting from Baghdad made him famous around the world. Coming up in the second part of our interview, Arnett discusses the many risks he took before the Gulf War and why he thinks of himself as a fatalist. Also, Mongolian throat singing. World music commentator Milo Miles reviews the debut album of the Mongolian group Hunher Tu. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. At the age of 59, Peter Arnett isn't yet ready to stop covering wars. He's been at it for 35 years, first for the Associated Press, then CNN. His work has taken him through Central America, the Middle East, Russia, and Asia. Of course, it was his live reports from Baghdad during the Gulf War that made him known around the world. He's written a new memoir called Live from the Battlefield. We talked about his Gulf War reports in the first part of our interview. I told him I thought most war correspondents gave up that beat when they were considerably younger than he is.
In fact, the journalists I met in the 50s, when I joined the Associated Press, were war correspondents in their 40s and 50s. Pat Morin, Relman Morin of the Associated Press, was on his umpteenth war. Hal Boyle came to Vietnam in his late 50s. He had won a Pulitzer in World War II. He had covered Korea. Kies Beach, who was then with the Chicago Daily News, he'd spent it all his life. He had been in lots of wars. Up to recent times, you know, war correspondents tend to hang around quite a long time. So it was not unusual in Asia or in Europe in that time to have these 50, 60-year-old correspondents who were still covering wars. What has happened post-Vietnam is that war corresponding is not as sexy an occupation as it used to be. And one of the reasons is, the main reason is that the correspondents who covered Vietnam came out with no glory, with the public or even within their profession. You know, covering a losing war is almost as bad as fighting a losing war. No one benefits. And even though I won a Pulitzer Prize and others won awards in Vietnam, after Vietnam, you know, we did little to ennoble the war correspondents in the eyes of the public. In fact, many blamed the press's negative reporting for losing the war. So, you know, after Vietnam, it was a very brave young American journalist who would want to become a war correspondent, who would want to commit their lives to Central America or to the Middle East.
What kind of war insurance do you have?
War insurance. Do you know that I have never asked what war insurance I had? I believe in the Gulf War that CNN had million-dollar policies. But, you know, I have never asked about that. I would always hope that the company I worked for took care of me. But, you know, I'm a fatalist, and I just don't want to tempt fate by checking on in insurance and other financial matters. That's of interest to my loved ones and my family, of course. And as I said earlier, I hope the company takes care of me. But I just don't go into any action or any conflict thinking that I may not come out. I like to have a positive view.
So if you're a fatalist, that means you're not putting your life in God's hands.
No, I would not suggest that God is the one who's watching over me. And I would think that would be much too much to ask to have a guiding hand governing what I do. I mean, what I do is my own decision making. The risks I take are mine only, and I would not want to impose on anyone, from God to the president of CNN, to watch over me. No, I feel that what I do is, it's the consequences have to rest totally on me.
My guest is Peter Arnett. He's written a new autobiography called Live from the Battlefield. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Arnett, who's written a new book about his coverage of the Gulf War, his coverage of Vietnam, and about 15 other wars, and his book is called Live from the Battlefield. What was the closest call you've ever had?
Well, I talk about that in my book. I talk about several moments. At one time in 1966 in January, as I was on a patrol west of Saigon with a wonderful American battalion commander, George Eister, and who insisted that I go out with his unit, and I was with him standing jungle trail around mid-morning, and a sniper opened fire as we were looking at a map, and he took four bullets in the chest and was dead within a day. And on another occasion, I was in with an American unit that was really embattled in the Dak To region in 1967, and I came out of a bunker to put twigs and earth on top of it to better reinforce it, and a U.S. plane came over and dropped two bombs accidentally into that unit. One exploded harmlessly, and the other landed 10, 15 feet from me and did not explode. And I looked at that bomb coming in, and I knew that I was dead. And I just did not panic. I just reflected how I would look after it impacted, but it didn't explode. So those two are the closest calls I can remember. On the other hand, if you're in an environment of conflict, you know, there are things, pieces and bits and pieces of metal flying around you, and any one of those could have your name on it.
When you thought you were going to get killed by that grenade, did it surprise you that you were so collected about it?
By the bomb? No,
I wasn't
surprised. I had no time to panic. It was, I saw the bomb coming in, and it was, we're talking about a second or two, and I had no time to panic. I only had time to reflect. The brain works much faster than the body.
I guess this is the kind of thing that helps build a fatalist.
Well, it helps build fatalism, but it also, it helps build confidence and experience. What I took to Baghdad in the Gulf War was, you know, 30 years of being in very difficult circumstances, knowing that the brakes often are on my side. And that's why I was so confident in Baghdad and stayed, and why journalists younger than me decided they didn't want to stay. They had not been around the years I had been. I had that experience, and in the end, experience really counts.
I appreciate what you're saying, but wasn't there maybe a point when all of your colleagues were trying to get out of Iraq, or at least trying to get to the bomb shelter of the Al-Rashid Hotel, when you were saying to yourself, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm taking a fatal risk here. Maybe I won't survive this.
I have never, in Baghdad, I never even thought that. Now, when I was in Afghanistan recently, in autumn, this past autumn, bullets were flying, and we're in situations where I thought, you know, what am I doing here? Afghanistan? Who cares? But I was with a good team of CNN people, and we prevailed. But I had doubts about being there at times, going on lonely roads and lots of armed militiamen around and thieves and hoods generally. There were bad things happening. In Baghdad, there was just a purity of story. It was just the opportunity was so inviting that at no point was I concerned that, you know, I had gone too far. Now, I spent my time in the bunkers too. Don't think that I just stood outside and defied the elements. I was also in the bunker at nights. And when I was not able to broadcast, I was scarce. You know, I was hiding. But when the moments came to broadcast, when the moments came to get out of the hotel and to get into the countryside, then it was a wonderful opportunity to gather information and present it to a vast audience. I mean, I was born to cover events like this. That's what news is all about. And so at no point was I concerned that I'd made the wrong decision. And even if a missile had come through that window in the Al Rashid Hotel, I would hope that those who were reflected on it would think that, you know, these guys were there doing what they feel was important, what has to be done. And I really feel that what I do and what my colleagues do has to be done.
When you got to Vietnam, you carried a pistol. What was the reason for that?
Well, I didn't carry it when I got there. I simply
started
carrying one as the war increased.
Yeah.
Initially, it was a guerrilla war. It was dangerous to drive the roads. The Viet Cong guerrillas were basically faceless and portrayed by the Saigon government, by the U.S., and by the press as being basically terrorists. You know, they were looked upon as, terrorists were in Lebanon in the 1980s, or as we portray terrorism out of Afghanistan today, aimed at the World Trade Center, for example. We in Vietnam looked upon the Viet Cong as being terrorists, and therefore, when we traveled, we wanted to defend ourselves against being captured. At that point, it was generally understood that to be captured would be to be killed. And so I and other correspondents tended to carry weapons with us. When the American troops were committed to the war, sometimes riding helicopters into the countryside, we would be expected to carry weapons for the support of the crew if the helicopter went down. If we didn't carry a gun, I mean, we were expected to carry a gun to help in the defense of the unit. In my book, I talk about being in Song Bay at a special forces camp one night when I manned a machine gun at the berm in the face of an expected Viet Cong attack. Fortunately, it didn't materialize. That was a different ethic. I don't apologize for it. It made sense at the time. Today, no way would I pick up a gun, or I don't think any other journalist would be, because the national interests are so blurred that in a place like Iraq, for example, Saddam Hussein, who was our ally for 10 years, overnight became our enemy. And certainly I, as a reporter, wasn't interested in shooting any Iraqis. Or maybe in Somalia or Afghanistan, those forces fighting each other, really, we don't have any role to play, or the media, we don't have, even if we risk our lives, I don't think we are in a position to defend ourselves physically and violently. We have to go with the flow. So I think that era has passed.
Did you ever shoot in Vietnam?
I never did have cause to fire my weapon at any crisis situation. I practiced a few times at firing ranges. The few times I carried the gun when possible conflict was imminent, I was never called upon to do so. I'm glad I wasn't, because I'd hate to have thought that I was pulling the trigger and would have killed someone. Some of my colleagues did get involved to a small degree in action, but generally it was not done. We carried notebooks, we carried cameras, and we didn't really get involved in the action much.
Peter Arnett, you grew up in New Zealand. Would you describe the town that you're from? Tell us a little bit about what it's like.
I was born in a little fishing and oystering town called Bluff, which is at the bottom end of New Zealand. And in my youth, I used to go to the hill that overlooked the town and look south to the Antarctic, which was only 1,500 miles away. And then there was a signpost at the little point at the end of the town, which had directions to many cities around the world, to Tokyo and New York, and 10,000, 12,000 miles away. And I used to sit under that signpost and dream about traveling. Bluff was a small working-class village. The main business was oystering, fishing, handling international shipping. Three or four ships would come in at a time to take New Zealand's meat out of the town. But it was a quiet, sort of dissolute place, because the fishermen and oystermen used to drink a lot and have a good time. They were into rugby and cricket and sports. And there was not an intellectual amongst the whole population of the town. There were 2,000 people. I fortunately had parents who saw that youths like me were doing too much drinking, hanging around the bars, you know, going into fishing and oystering and pretty ordinary pursuits. And they encouraged me and my two brothers to get an education. They sent me to a boarding school and to get me out of Bluff. And so I set course for Australia and overseas. I was back in Bluff a couple of years ago, and I'm sad to say it hasn't changed. The hotel bars are the biggest industry in the town, and youths as young as I was 40 years ago are still doing a lot of drinking, and I would like to see that change and more young people there get out and do something with their lives.
One last question for you. Today in Washington, where you're speaking to us from, it's been a miserable weather day. There was an ice storm. You've got, I think, 2 or 3 inches of ice on the roads. Very dangerous. Everybody's been urged to stay home. You, of course, made it to the studio a little bit late because the driving was slow. But we kind of assumed, well, if anybody's going to get to the studio, it's certainly going to be Peter Arnett. I guess after covering wars, something like ice on the streets isn't going to stop you.
Well, no, but you know, I want to remind you, I am not superhuman. I'm of moderate stature, and I am as human as anyone else. But of course, I would get to the studio, and a few inches of ice would not stop me. But I am not superhuman, and I've had the good fortune, really, to survive a lot of very dangerous encounters, and some wonderful colleagues of mine did not survive. And just one last word: when I was in Baghdad covering that war, one of the reasons I stayed was that I knew my colleagues from Vietnam and Latin America who had been killed would have been right there with me, and there was no way I was going to let them down by bugging out of that war.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Arnett has written an autobiography called Live from the Battlefield. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Los Angeles today?
Well, among other things, we'll be hearing from Northridge, near the epicenter of the earthquake. And also we'll be talking with one of our friends out in Los Angeles as he drives around, talks to us on his car phone, describing what it's like trying to go back to work today. Also today, we'll hear about the Independent Counsel's final report on the Iran-Contra scandal, a reminder of what that was all about. And we'll be hearing about Bobby Ray Inman, who had been nominated to be President Clinton's Secretary of Defense, who today withdrew his nomination, citing negative stories, mostly by New York Times columnist William Safire.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Occasionally, a type of music that would seem utterly foreign and incomprehensible to an American audience proves to have great appeal. The Bulgarian Women's Choir is one example. World music commentator Milo Miles says he's found another potential hit from the extremely remote region of Tuva in Mongolia, near the center of Asia. The throat singers of the group Hun Her Tu.
In order to get with Tuvan music at all, you have to understand the weird and wonderful phenomena of throat singing. It's performed in a few parts of the world, but really flourishes in Central Asia. Here, Buddhist monks use it for chanting, and the herdsmen of Tuva have made it the center of their vocal music. Especially until recently, it was almost exclusively a male practice. What happens is that from the middle of a guttural, gurgling chant, a strange whistling or trilling arises, and it sounds like two voices at the same time. Call it harmonic override. There are at least 5 varieties of throat singing, and Kaigal Ul Kovalig, the leader of Hun Her Tu, is a master. Remember, there is only one person singing in this example.
Ooh.
Tuvans call their throat singing Hume, but it's only one charm of Hun Her Tu and their debut release, 60 Horses in My Herd. The quartet also excel on guitar, various percussion, and conch shell drones. But the standout is the playing by Kovalig on the Ijil, a kind of three-string cello. Hun Her Tu's instrumental accompaniment has little of the severity and unfamiliar rhythms that put Western listeners off many Asian bands. Indeed, their songs communicate vibrantly, particularly feelings of longing and awe. This next number is about missing a friend, and quite plaintive it is, though not nearly as sad as the song about the orphan they do in concert. Shoo. Mongolia is a generally harsh environment, and Tuvans are tough cowboy and cowgirl types with a culture centered around horses. Indeed, a man bases his identity on his horse, the work he does with them, and the landscape he rides through. So maybe the immediate appeal of Hun Her Tu has something to do with cowboys the world around. They all seem to possess that high, lonesome sound, and they sing bouncy tunes about driving the herds, whether they're driving cattle, or in this case, camels. It's rugged individualism on parade.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed 60 Horses in My Herd from the group Hun Her Tu on the Shanaki label. The group is currently on a U.S. tour. They're performing this weekend in Columbus, Ohio, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.